front of where the teacher normally is, so I scooted. Trent and Scott do for the rest of the time in here is up to them. Looking forward to this material. I have been looking forward to this material for some time. Maybe I was a little bit early, but as usual, I have a lot of information to cover. So, really looking forward to this material and doing this material again. Am I not
picking up? Okay. All right. Sounds good. If we were to go back to in the history of this congregation, back to when Bob Waldron got here, there was an excitement that was generated about seeing the Bible as one big story, as one picture, as God's unfolding plan of redemption from Genesis 1, the tree of life, all the way to Revelation chapter 20 and 21, where you see the heavens, the new heavens and the new earth. And this quarter is talking about doing all of that in one quarter. So we can back up and get the big picture. You know, as an illustration, this past quarter we were doing the epistles in short segments. And this next quarter, we're going to be teaching the book of Revelation in six classes. I had studied that book several times. I'd even taught the book a couple of times. But there was things this past quarter that by looking at that book in six classes and having to back up to the 50,000 foot view of this and literally just see the book as the story unfolds, put a lot of the questions that I had about the book in perspective. It brought a lot of clarity to some of my other studies of the book of Revelation just simply by backing up and seeing the big picture before I got off into the weeds. So that's really what this whole quarter is going to be about, backing up and seeing the big picture. And then starting next quarter, we'll start diving in to the details. I would say growing up that if you would have told me the Bible was one long story, I would have looked at you with odd colored glasses. I mean, what are you talking about? Right? Because on Sunday mornings, I would be studying a prophet. On Sunday evenings or Wednesday evenings, I might be studying the New Testament. The next time, I might be talking about the Proverbs and the life of Christ in the other class. And I never really put it all together. So when I actually, after I become a Christian and I started attending here, and then Bob came here, and this emphasis was put in that it is one long story. God's story of redemption from the beginning to the end. So we're going to start off with three things today. One is the goals for this study, the goals for our Bible class system. Two, why do we even study the Old Testament? Legitimate questions to ask. Why do we even study the Old Testament? And three, why geography? Because a large part of this quarter is going to be about geography as well. So why are we studying the Old Testament? Why are we studying geography? What does this do to help our faith? Well, as we said, this is one big story. It started with the very beginning of time where man was put on earth and he was given one choice to make. All the trees you can have, but this tree of life, the tree of knowledge of good and evil, the tree of life, you can eat of all you want, the tree of knowledge, good and evil, you can't eat of that tree. Right? One choice to make. Mankind failed. From that point, sin entered the world. God is a holy God. God cannot stand sin. He can't be around sin. Sin cannot be in His presence. Mankind separated themselves from God. Romans 3:23, we've all sinned, fallen short of the glory of God. Paul also tells us in Romans, the wages of sin is death, right? We deserve death. At the point Satan tempts Eve, Eve takes of the fruit. Then Eve takes it to her husband takes the fruit. Fate was sealed. Thankfully, in Ephesians chapter 3 and verse 11, we learn that according to the eternal purpose, God's eternal purpose, which He accomplished in Christ Jesus our Lord, God had a plan from beginning before this ever happened. Again, God all-knowing, He knew what was going to happen. But even though mankind broke that relationship, God had a way to put it back together. He had already planned for that. So let's ask the question, why are we doing this now? One of the things that kind of sparked this was sitting at a lunch table one time with Wayne. Wayne looked at me and said, "Do you know, I found an old directory from 2010. 178 names of the 2010 Eastside directory is no longer here." So, In 2010, this cycle, this approach of knowing the 17 periods, knowing the passages, the bookends of the 17 periods, knowing a lot of the list and a lot of the details of each one of these periods, it was this whole congregation, we were all about it. Just ask Freddie. You know, I remember sitting at Freddie's house week after week. We'd go over there on Sunday night and do drill after drill. It was a part of who we were. But since 2010, that's 75% of the congregation, this family, that is new, that is different. So we're going to start that again. It's one story. We call them 17 periods. I call it, you know, I think of it as a filing cabinet with two drawers, the Old Testament and the New Testament. And in those, inside of filing cabinet drawers, you've got folders, right? Each folder is a period. And on that label of the folder, I would write before the flood, the scattering of the people on each one of those folders. And then under before the flood, I would have Genesis chapter 1 through chapter 5. And as I began to learn things, I would go, oh yeah, I'm going to file that information away in this folder. And that's really, when we start talking about the three cycle approach, that's really what it is. Cycle 1, let's learn the periods. Cycle 2, let's add the bookmarks, the Bible passages. What books do I go to cover this material, to know this material? Where do I turn? Now when somebody says something to me about Jacob and I go, patriarch, he's one of the patriarchs. That's obviously Genesis 12 through Genesis 50. Now let me start working my way through. Oh yeah, about chapter 28, we start learning about Jacob. So anything I need to know about him, I can start going to that particular area. This material helps. It's one big story with many breakdowns. Personally, I like the filing cabinet approach. Some people like hooks on the wall. Every period is a hook. Every time I learn something, I go and hang it on the hook, right? I hang that on the hook of before the flood. I hang that fact on the hook of the divided kingdom. And as you begin to learn those lists, you'll also notice a lot of those lists are nothing more but another outline of that particular period. If you want to outline the united and divided kingdom, united kingdom is pretty easy. Saul, David, Solomon. The divided kingdom pretty a little more complicated when you start thinking about the kings of the united kingdom, the kings of the divided kingdom. But again, those names give you an outline to go through this material. So as we see that this is one large story from beginning to end, sin came into the world. God could not stand sin. God had to do something about sin. We also learn in 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 9, the Lord is not slack concerning His promises, as some count slackness, but is long-suffering toward us, not willing that any should perish, but all come to repentance. So, we had sinned. We had separated ourselves from God. God did not want it that way. So from the beginning of time, He begins to tell the story of redemption. How He's going to bring His people back to Him, back in relationship with Him, to restore that relationship of ultimately, the end of the book of Revelation in heaven, how He's going to restore that relationship between Himself and His people. At the beginning with Abraham, He gives three promises, or makes a promise in Genesis chapter 12, 2, 3, and verse 7. And if I was to go and to look to any one of our little children in the back of the building and say, what's the three promises that God made to Abraham? Land, seed, and nation, right? Do we know that as well as our little ones do? One of the other things, He promised those three things. I will make of you a great nation. Through your seed, all families of the earth would be blessed. Speaking of the Christ to come. I'll make of you a great nation. Through your seed, all the families of the earth will be blessed. And then He tells him, look at this land. This is the land that I'll give to your descendants. The rest of the scriptures is the unfolding of those promises. Genesis 3:15. I'll put enmity, talking to Satan, I'll put enmity between you and the woman, between your seed and her seed. You shall bruise his heel, he shall bruise your head. The fulfillment of that promise where Christ is going to come in and crush Satan, and the fulfillment of the promises of the land, seed, and nation promise ultimately in Christ is the telling of the story. One of the really nice things when I start looking at our goals, and the nice thing about you guys doing this in here at the same time your children are doing it in the classrooms in the back is by the time our children graduate high school, they should have been from Genesis to Revelation three times. I know I could not say that when I graduated high school. right? Each time, adding a little more detail, they've got a little bit more knowledge. They already have a little bit of grasp of the base story. We can add more depth each time we go through, and we can add more application each time they go through. So hopefully by the time they're in the high school and college class, they've got the stories of what's gone on in the book of Genesis, and whoever is teaching in that class can actually do kind of what Wayne and Jeff did here a few quarters ago, where you're actually talking about family relationships from that quarter. Each pass through, you go with more detail, more depth, but then after you have the basic facts, you can go with more application. The other nice thing is all school age kids are studying the same thing, right? So if you've got multiple kids, multiple classes, they may not be in the same chapter or the same book or have the same questions, but you're studying the same basic material all the time. So it makes really good family time, right? The family can come together and study together, and you know everybody is in Genesis basically within a few chapters of one another. And one of the other huge goals that we have here is the teachers go to the foundation class the quarter before they teach. And I could say, hey, I'm going to be teaching Genesis. It's okay. I've got that. But when I go to the foundations class, what I'm doing is I'm training my brain not only to remember the things that I've forgotten from the material I'm teaching, but also say, how am I going to take this material and get it across to the four-year-old? How am I going to take this material and get it through the thick skull of the 16-year-old or the 21-year-old? I'll use my son as an example. Get through to whatever the age group that I'm talking to is. I like Wayne's illustration for this. Our Bible class program is kind of like a three-legged stool. And if you've ever seen a three-legged stool, if you take one of those three legs away, is that still very useful? It's hard to sit on a three-legged stool with only two legs. One is you've got to have prepared teachers. Because if a teacher is not prepared, it really doesn't matter. It will not be a good class. It will not be a successful class. You've got to have interested students. So to the parents in this room, you've got a large job in helping your child be interested in the material that they're going in to teach, that they're going in. And three, you've got to have involved parents. I can ask any teacher, and I can ask Aaron back here from Little Tots. I can ask teachers in elementary. I can ask Janie in middle school, anybody in high school. If the teachers aren't involved, what about the performance of the kids? There is a huge correlation to the involvement of the parents and involvement of the kids. Guess what? The same is true here. If the parents are involved, if the parents are excited about the same material that the kids are, it will go much better. And the other biggest thing here is anyone of any age can do it. Go back a few years, and I can think of some of the ones. I'd have to ask Freddie for help with some of the names, but I can think of some of the ones who would say, I could never learn that list of 17 periods, or I could never learn that. And to see the excitement on their face when they got to where they could rattle it off, right? Even more importantly, the excitement on their face when they started hearing some fact or they started hearing some story and they started connecting the dots for themselves. One of the things that I remember Bob saying was, the system of teaching has made it when the teachers no longer need my workbooks in the classrooms. I didn't think much about it when Bob first said it in the late 90s. But I noticed somewhere 2006, 2007, that more and more of the teachers was walking into the classroom and opening their Bible and not Bob and Sandra's book in the beginning when they was teaching Genesis. Now, for each teacher, that's a cycle of your own, right? The first time through, yes, you need those helps, those aids as you're preparing and as you're trying to, how do I get this material into this amount of classes? But I find it really interesting that the cycle happened. And in our classrooms, the only thing that was really ever being opened anymore was the Bible. Workbooks gone. You know, Sandra's books. They were there, they were given so that each family, and if there's any homes here that don't have a copy of his books, let us know. We'll make sure that every home has got a full set. Even the history and geography book that we're doing this time, which I think this is the first time this particular material has ever been covered in the auditorium class. But that's when we know we've somewhat made it. This is important. and it's required to know God. One of the happiest times for me was when my child was about 4, 5. We were playing in the pool out in the backyard one day, and I said, "Hey Lee, what's 17 periods?" He told them to me. I said, "Okay, so," and I asked him another question, then another question, and before I knew it, Lee had told me the entire story of the Bible from Genesis to God bringing back the new heaven and the new earth. And he was 5. So if there's anybody here that's got any doubt they can do it, yeah, you can do it. I've seen 5-year-olds do it. There's kids in the back that can do it. We were on a camping trip, and a lot of the young ones here was there. We got out Friday night, they'd sung a little bit, and then there was a group of the teenagers that got the kids out, and they were all laying on the ground looking up at the stars. And they started playing a game, person, place, or thing. And they began to start quizzing each other. That game sounds easy until they start asking you, okay, Old Testament, New Testament, Old Testament, period of history, answer the period of history. And they begin to start quizzing you about really detailed facts as they're trying to figure out who it is you're thinking of. And you go, oh, wow. Was that, you know, which king, you know, little Noah look up and go, okay, which king was this character a part of the story of? And you go, oh, which king? Wait a minute. We've gotten past the divided kingdom. Which king in the divided kingdom was this character a story of? To hear the characters that these kids were coming up with. Things like Nebuchadnezzar, right? Talking 3rd and 4th graders. Not only were they letting the others ask them questions and they were able to answer them, they were stumping one another. And I'm talking Noah Lee. I'm talking Zeta Fielder. I'm talking some of those that we look at and go, oh, they're just children. It can be learned. It can be learned at any age. And it is important. So, let's turn to our second question, legitimate question. Why do we study the Old Testament? Right? Why don't we just spend all of our time in the New Testament? Why do we even spend time studying the Old Testament? One might say the Old Testament was taken away so that the new might be put in place. And to that question, I would say, you're absolutely right. The Old Testament was taken away. A brief look at the book of Hebrews, Hebrews chapter 8 and verse 7 says, "For if the first covenant had been faultless, there had been no need sought for a second." Right? So the first covenant had problems, therefore there was a second covenant to come. So, okay, maybe the question is legitimate. The first covenant's been taken away. Why do we care? Why should we study this? Hebrews chapter 8 and verse 13. "A new covenant. The first he's made obsolete. Now what is becoming obsolete is growing old and is ready to vanish away." That's right. The Ten Commandments, the old covenant, the old law, it became obsolete. It was vanished away. Hebrews chapter 10 and verse 9. He said, "Behold, I come down to do your will, O God." He takes away the first that he may establish the second. So yes, it's going away. So if it's going away, why should I care to look at it? Why should I care to know about it? That's a question that we might need to answer. Secondly, we might ask the question, we're no longer under the old law. We're not to keep the Sabbath. We're not to go offer sacrifices, right? We're not to bring the firstborn of our flock. And if we don't have one, we go and we buy one, even if I can only afford a turtle dove. I go and I purchase that sacrifice. I cut the throat. I offer that sacrifice up to God. That's not our law. That's not our system of worship to the Lord anymore. So if that has gone away, why do I even study? And I will say we have to have a word of caution here. But I also think part of the word of caution is also part of the word of why it's important to study the Old Testament. Because if you know what's in the Old and what's in the New, you can kind of help determine what's gone away and no longer and what's still held to us as law today. But there are a lot of people that will go into the Old Testament and say, I want to do this and I can do this because the old law commanded it. Or it's a Ten Commandment. Well, I'll say that if there is a Ten Commandment that I still need to be observing today, it's because it's been repeated under the New Covenant, under the New Testament. We better be careful at going back and reaching in and cherry-picking things out of the old law and putting them up on a pedestal and saying, I can still do this, I should still do this today. And likewise, we should be careful and not say, well, think of the thing, you know, a lot of the principles that we get on the conversation of modesty, some of those, or even seeing, some of those principles come from Old Testament scriptures and say, well, no, it's not in the New Testament, therefore I've got to throw it away. We don't need to either throw it away or bind it upon ourselves, but we need to understand it. And we need to understand it for a couple of reasons. It teaches us what sin is. Right? Well, let me go back for just a second. Those verses in Colossians chapter 2 and verse 14, this second part, we're no longer under the old law. It makes it very clear. He's wiped away the handwriting requirement that was against us, which was contrary to us. He's taken it out of the way and he's nailed it to the cross. A popular verse in Galatians chapter 3 and verse 24, therefore the law was our tutor to bring us to Christ, that we may be justified by faith. But after faith has come, we are no longer under a tutor. So you've got these situations where Christ, through Paul, has made it very clear the Old Testament's to go away. It was a tutor to bring us to Christ. But now that we have Christ, the law is no longer of effect to us. And I really find it very interesting in Romans chapter 7, Paul uses the concept of marriage and a wife being bound to her husband for as long as the husband is alive. So you have this law that you have a husband and wife and they are bound, and they are absolutely bound, and they are bound. What God has put together, let not man separate. God has put them together and they're bound until that husband dies. But after that husband dies, the wife is now free from that bond and is no longer bound to her husband. Paul uses that illustration to speak to the Jews and say, we were bound to the law, but the law is now dead. We are no longer bound to this law that was once dead. We think of, back to Galatians chapter 3, it being a tutor to bring us to Christ. No, after we have Christ, we no longer need the tutor. But what's the purpose of a tutor? Right? The tutor is the one that teaches us something. If I was to remember back to my high school days, which was a couple of years ago, I can remember Mr. Owen Griggs was one of my teachers. I had government with Mr. Owen Griggs. I know many of you know him. And as he would teach me government, while I was in his classroom, who was my authority? He was. While I was at East Limestone High School, Mr. Johnson, our principal, that was my authority. The day I stepped out of that school and had graduated, what authority did they have over me? That was gone. That was my old schoolmaster. That was my tutor. It brought me to a certain point, and now I'm no longer accountable to these guys. That's what Christ has done. The law was a tutor to bring us to the point of Christ. Now we're no longer accountable. So these are legitimate questions about why maybe we shouldn't study the Old Testament. But if we didn't have the Old Testament, first and foremost, we wouldn't know what sin was. Romans chapter 7 and verse 7. What shall we say then? Is it law? Certainly not. On the contrary, I would not have known sin except through the law. I would not have known covetousness unless the law said, you shall not covet. How would we know what sin is today if it wasn't for the law? Right? We had those things. It was natural law from the very beginning that God expected man to know, and, you know, whether it be sexuality, whether it be whatever it happens to be, those were things we were to know from nature itself. But you think about a lot of things that we consider that all the nations since beginning of time have considered right and wrong, we wouldn't have known it was sin. We wouldn't have known covetousness was sin if the law had not said so. So it is our teacher, it is our schoolmaster, to bring us along to Christ. And through it, we know God's character. We can learn a lot of things about Christ in the New Testament, but without the law, there's so much of His character we would not know. You can fall in love with God by reading the Psalms and seeing His love for us. You can see both the goodness and the severity of God as He poured Himself out to save His people, and yet brought judgment and held them accountable when they would not be faithful to Him. You see the cycle over and over in the Judges, where God's doing everything He can to bring His people back. And yet, they do okay for a little while and then they fall away and turn back. And if you and if I cannot see myself in those characters and understand and learn from that, I'm missing something huge. So the old law, it teaches us of God's character. It tells us how bad we hurt Him. We do, but we don't see in the New Testament near as much how our sins hurt God as we do in the Old Testament. When you read through the Old Testament, you see the pain of what Israel's actions did to the Creator. Right? Through the Old Testament, we see how our actions make God feel. We see God's power. Need I say, the walls of Jericho falling from people marching around? That don't happen. Red Sea doesn't part. The Creator who created this earth, the God that we serve, His power is held up in the Old Testament, and our knowledge would be highly lacking. His holiness. He is holy. Nadab and Abihu is a great example of a story that teaches His holiness. He must, as Moses said to Aaron, He must be regarded as holy. We see that in the Old Testament. So it was written, as Paul says in Romans chapter 15 and verse 7, it was written for our learning. It is profitable for us still today. 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 16 and 17, a passage we all know well. All Scripture is given by the inspiration of God and is profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, for instruction in righteousness, that the man of God may be complete, thoroughly equipped for every good work. It's profitable to us today. And it's vital to our understanding of the New Testament. We talk about being under the New Testament, and yet we are. But we have to understand it. We talked about that it is the law, the words of Christ. It is the New Testament. It is the new covenant that we're going to stand before God and answer. That's the book He's going to open. It's an open book test at the end, right? John chapter 12, verses 48 and 49. It's an open book test. But if you don't know the material, it's going to be really hard to pass the test, right? We've got to know this. This is what we're going to be judged by. It is vital to our understanding. If you was to go to Hebrews chapter 10 and you see Paul making all these arguments about Christ being the ultimate sacrifice, well, if you didn't know about the sacrifice system of the Old Testament, Hebrews chapter 10 not only would have no meaning to you, it would be absolute confusion. There would be no understanding of Hebrews 10 if there was not. You go to John chapter 5, where they are furious with Christ and they're trying to catch Christ, and they catch the man who's walking on the Sabbath carrying his bed. Blasphemy! You're working on the Sabbath, you're walking around carrying your bed. Well, if you didn't know the Old Testament, you would go, why in the world do the Jewish leadership care that this man is walking around on a Saturday with his bed in his hand? He was profaning the Sabbath. Christ, how dare you heal on the Sabbath? You're profaning the Sabbath. These things would not make any sense. In our study of the book of Revelation, I think is one of the best illustrations of this point. In the book of Revelation, you think about allusions or references or comments or quotes from the Old Testament, 57 times in the book of the 440 verses, 57 times references are made back to Genesis, some allusion or some illustration from there. 11 times back to the historical writings, 45 times back to the poets, 197 to the major prophets, and 38 references to the minor prophets. I can assure you, without an understanding of the prophets in the Old Testament, you are lost in the book of Revelation. Without an understanding of the Old Testament, you are lost in a study of Hebrews. Right? You just can't have one without the other. Of 404 verses in the book of Revelation, 278 contain references to the Old Testament. Almost two-thirds of that book. Hopefully, we've covered this, that we cannot understand the new without knowing the old. And if you want to study evidences, think about all those promises that was made hundreds or thousands of years. You got a prophet that's calling Darius by name hundreds of years, 300 years before he's even born. That, you know, the author of that book must have divine power. It tells things that are way far to come. And that speaks to its power and to its importance. And it also is a great book of evidence for us. Now, with our last 8 to 10 minutes, let's talk about the question, why study geography? And to my school teaching friends in the room, I'm going ahead and apologize for my next statement. But when I got to geography in school, I went, oh, please, no, please, 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 no, don't make me do this. Do not make me take this class. Do not make me learn this. I just simply do not care. And for a fourth, fifth grader, that's probably a very common response. Maybe a common response back there. But as our teachers are using geography to teach, I hope they're using the geography to make the stories come alive. You cannot understand this book when it starts talking about the Negev, the south. You see how dry and how arid. Are you just going to run out into this wilderness without food and water? Are you just going to pick up tent and live there? No, you're not going to live here. So as we start thinking about how geography happens, no matter where someone was in Jerusalem, they could be, or in Israel, they could be in Galilee, they could be in Jericho, they could be on the Mediterranean, Tyre and Sidon. No matter where they're coming from, they are going up to Jerusalem. Critics go, yeah, this book is great. They don't know north, south, east, and west. And you ask yourself the question, or maybe the student asks their question, no matter where they're coming from, why are they going up to Jerusalem?
Starting east of the Jordan River, let's follow the road from Jericho to Jerusalem on map 1-9. The road brings us through the different districts of Jericho, including the residential area and municipal Jericho. Passing through municipal Jericho, the road begins climbing up the ascent of Adumim, a ridge on the south side of the deep Wadi Kilt Canyon. Continuing through the rocky Judean wilderness, the road descends into a canyon called Nahal Og, which acts like a moat guarding Jerusalem's eastern approach. The road climbs up another ridge, then over the Mount of Olives, to Jerusalem. This cross-section diagram shows the different segments of the route that travels from Jericho to Jerusalem. This is the route that Jesus took on his last journey up to Jerusalem. Note on the lower right-hand side of the screen, Jericho sits at 800 feet, or 250 meters, below sea level. Jesus would have passed through the different districts of Jericho. First, the residential area, and then about 1.5 miles away was municipal Jericho, built by the Hasmoneans and Herod the Great. From municipal Jericho, the route climbs on a ridge called the Ascent of Adumim, or the Red Ascent, to a ridge crest, where Roman and Crusader period forts guarded the road. From the forts, the road descends into a canyon called Nahal Og, and then continues up toward Jerusalem on a ridge where parts of the Roman road can still be seen today. It reaches the eastern shoulder of the Mount of Olives, and then climbs over the top of the mountain. Finally, the road descends down into the Kidron Valley before ascending into the city of Jerusalem. The straight line distance between Jerusalem and Jericho is 14 miles or 22 kilometers. But there is an elevation difference of 3,300 feet, or 1,000 meters.
And I will say, newfound respect after having taken a recent hike, what it would be like, you know, after going 3 miles, can I imagine going 14 at that kind of incline? To gain 3,000 feet in 14 miles, huge. Does that give us perspective when we're telling the stories? Think of the number of stories that we hear about the conversations. How long of a conversation could Christ have with his apostles as they would go from Jericho to Jerusalem? If I could just set out and walk 14 miles, maybe not that long, but that ascent would take a while.
We know here an example of the geographical detail and accuracy of the scriptures. The book of Joshua, chapter 15, verse 7, says that the border between the tribal allotments of Judah and Benjamin goes along the ascent of Adumim, which is south of the valley, meaning south of the Wadi Kilt. Benjamin's allotment is to the north, Judah is to the south.
When you start thinking about battles, when you start thinking about the different things that's going on, you're not going to fight here. Look at the terrain on both sides. You've got a fairly small, narrow path. Let your mind go forward just a little bit to the New Testament when the Good Samaritan is taken and robbed on the road to Damascus. That the different ones pass by and the Good Samaritan stops and helps.
The Mount of Olives is on the horizon to the west.
We're standing on a section of the Roman road that went from Jerusalem higher up in the hills through the Judean desert to Jericho. This is the road where the Good Samaritan helped a man who had fallen among thieves.
Not a lot of room there, right? The stop to the side, one side or the other, or even the effort that it probably took the man once he put the man on his donkey to get him up to the top, to get him to an inn, to take him in. The geography gives us newfound perspective. Now take your mind forward even a little bit further when the crowds were throwing it in on Jesus and he says, I'm going to put in a boat and push away. Had you ever sat around and wondered, you've got all these multitudes and multitudes of people that are gathering around Jesus and how in the world can they all even hear him talk? Right? How can they hear him? He said then the first time he feeds 5,000 that have gathered to hear him with a few loaves and a few fish. Then in an instance a little bit later, he feeds another 4,000. How is there a place where Jesus, you know, this is before microphones, before listening devices, before everything else, how is there a place where Jesus can speak and this kind of people can hear him
back from the shore and spoke up to the people that were still on the land? Now, standing here in this cove, you can turn around and see it forms kind of a natural amphitheater. And it's really easy to imagine Jesus, this is his stage as he turns and faces the people and speaks up to them.
Many people have questioned whether or not Jesus could actually be heard by a large group of people if he's a few feet off the shoreline. Let's do an experiment. Let me go up the hill a little ways. When I get up there, I want you to read the parable of the sower in a natural but loud speaking voice. And let me see if I can hear it.
Sounds good.
As he's walking, notice the distance he gets to and see the distance between them.
If I can hear you.
All right, I'm going to read from Matthew 13.
That same day, Jesus went out of the house and sat beside the sea, and great crowds gathered about him, so that he got into a boat and sat down.
Teachers, that's your responsibility, to make geography, make the stories come to life for the kids. That's really what a lot of this quarter is going to be about. As you start studying the cycle this quarter, we're down to just a few minutes left. As you start studying the cycle this quarter, you're going to be talking about this iterative approach. You're going to spend some time thinking of the 17 periods. Then you're going to add the beginning and end marks. And then you'll come back and you'll add more detail. You're going to be talking about geography and how geography plays into this. I'm excited about Trent teaching this material because Trent has been there, seen that, done that. He's been on digs in the places that we're talking about. He's been to digs in places that we dream to go. So you've got, especially for the geography section coming up, you've got an expert that's coming. Scott and Trent will do a terrific job with this next quarter and bringing this material to life. But please, let me take my last few minutes to say, please, help us get everybody excited about going through this again. Help us all get everybody excited about learning this material again, because what we're learning is not a bunch of facts. We're learning God's plan for salvation. And we're learning it so that we can take it to our neighbors, to the world around us, and everywhere else. And note that the youngest can do this. If the youngest can do this, you can do this as well. You don't want your kids or your grandkids to show you up, so you might ought to learn this material you're going through this quarter, so your kids don't walk up and say, Grandma, Grandpa, which period was Nebuchadnezzar in? I can tell you for sure it's embarrassing when your kid does it to you. Especially when it was 2 nights ago and he does it to you in front of a bunch of others, but that's a different, in front of all the kids that you're talking to. But no, with that there, everybody's coming in. I thank you for your time and attention, and I hope this quarter will be helpful to you, and I hope you'll enjoy it, and most importantly, you'll take it back to your families at home. Thank you, guys.